This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Seamus Haney with Dennis O'Driscoll, recorded in Santa Fe on October 1st, 2003. Seamus Haney's poetry bears witness to Ireland's complex and violent past and present, articulating the conflicts and tender mercies inherent in human experience. Haney reads from a wide range of poems and offers easy context for the thoughts, feelings, and events behind his work before joining in conversation with fellow poet and Irishman, Dennis O'Driscoll.
I'm shocked to discover I've been writing poems for 40 years, so you won't go hear all of them, but I'll read a few from the beginning and a few from more recently that aren't in any of the books. Poems which grew from the world in which I grew. Poems of childhood, poems even of infancy. Poems of Ireland and some poems with American bases. Poems born out of anxiety, poems born out of affection. All poems, in a sense, are born out of infancy. Infans, the Latin word, means unspeaking. And the infant is the unspeaking one. So all good poems have been gathered in silence and have moved from the unspoken need to the luck of getting spoken right. So the first poem I want to read is about the silence in the kitchen where I was in vans. I imagined it from the point of view of the infant in the cradle, taking in the atmosphere of this house. 1940s, traditional Irish whitewashed house, thatched. Sunlight, which as Dennis pointed out to me the other day, sunlight is a rarer thing in Ireland than it is in New Mexico. So this is basically a poem which wants to be a Vermeer but can't. But it's a woman is baking bread, making scones, heating the griddle. Anyway. It's called Moss Bon, which is the name of the house, Sunlight. Moss Bon, Sunlight. There was a sunlit absence. The helmeted pump in the yard heated its iron. Water honeyed in the slung bucket. And the sun stood like a griddle cooling against the wall of each long afternoon. So her hands scuffled over the bake board. The reddening stove sent its plaque of heat against her, where she stood in a flowery apron by the window. Now she dusts the board with a goose's wing, now sits broad-lapped, with whitened nails and measling shins. Here is a space again, the scone rising to the tick of 2 clocks. And here is love, like a tinsmith scoop, sunk past its gleam in the meal bin. Sometimes the silence in the house was a little strange. You come home from school, you would know, as the poet Patrick Kavanagh says, some strange thing had happened. You weren't quite sure what, but for a start, your mother wasn't in the kitchen. There was a faint scent of disinfectant, doctor smell. Your mother was in bed up the room. Beside her in the bed, there was something, yes, a little mite, another wee child. And somebody would say, when you were at school, the doctor brought a new wee brother for you in his bag. You know those beautiful old doctor's bags with a snib on them, plump living stone bags. So this poem is called Out of the Bag. And it's 2 bits of a slightly longer poem, but I thought of the doctor's surgery in Marafelt, the town near us, as a kind of mixed. I thought of a place where the assembly bits for all babies were hanging on. It was a kind of a combination of a gleaming laboratory and an old-style butcher shop. Well, I thought I had the book here. So I have. Out of the bag. All of us came in Dr. Carolyn's bag. He'd arrive with it, disappear to the room, and by the time he'd reappear to wash those nosy, rosy, big, soft hands of his in the scullery basin, its lined insides, the colour of a spaniel's inside lug, were empty for all to see. The trap-sprung mouth unsnibbed and gaping wide. Then, like a hypnotist unwinding us, he'd wind the instruments back into their lining, tie the cloth like an apron round itself, darken the door, and leave with the bag in his hand, a plump arc by the keel. Until the next time came, and in he'd come in his fur-lined leather collar, which was also spaniel-coloured, and go stooping up to the room again, a whiff of disinfectant, a Dutch interior gleam of waistcoat satin and highlights on the forceps. Getting the water ready, that was next. Not plumping hot and not lukewarm, but soft, sud-luscious, saved for him from the rain butt, and savoured by him afterwards, all thanks denied as he toweled hard and fast, then held his arms out suddenly behind him to be squired and silk-lined into the camel coat. At which point once he turned his eyes upon me, hyperborean, beyond the north wind blew. Two peepholes to the locked room I saw into every time his name was mentioned. Skimmed milk and ice, swabbed porcelain, the white and chill of tiles, steel hooks, chrome surgery tools, and blood drips in the sawdust where it thickened at the foot of each cold wall. And overhead, the little pendant, teat-hued infant parts strung neatly from a line up near the ceiling. A toe, a foot and shin, an arm, a cock, a bit like the rosebud in his buttonhole. The room I came from, and the rest of us all came from, stays pure reality, where I stand alone, standing the passage of time. And she's asleep in sheets put on for the doctor. Wedding presents that showed up again and again, bridal and usual and useful at births and at deaths. Me at the bedside, incubating for real, peering, appearing to her as she closes and opens her eyes, then lapses back into a faraway smile whose precinct of vision I would enter every time to assist and be asked in that hoarsened whisper of triumph. "And what do you think of the new wee baby the doctor brought for us all when I was asleep?" Thank you very much. Standing alone, standing the passage of time, in a much, much shorter poem you'll be glad to hear. It's a little poem called Oracle. Memory of being secluded in a hollow tree. And I remember going into it quite often, but I know from family lore that once upon a time I caused great panic by being lost in it. Panic, of course, is the fear associated with woods. So this was associated with one tree in this case. My parents were in panic. So they were crying out and shouting out my name. Amos. I used the word cuckoo. They were kind of looking for me all over the place. So I see it as I see in the poem myself as like a little uvula in the throat of the tree. This was in 1972 when I had ambitions to be the voice of the district, so to speak. But anyway, it's a little, just a little doodle. Oracle. Hide in the hollow trunk of the willow tree. It's listening familiar. Until, as usual, they cuckoo your name across the fields. You can hear them draw the poles of styles as they approach, calling you out. Small mouth and ear in a woody cleft. Lobe and larynx of the mossy places. This was trying to make poetry as natural as the moss on the tree. But of course, it is, on the one hand, natural. Remember Shakespeare, one of my favorite quotations about poetry, Shakespeare has a poet in the play Timon of Athens. In the very first page, you don't have to look far for this quotation if you want to look it up. Poet says, somebody says, "What, more or less, what have you brought for Timon? What gift have you?" And poet says, "A poem." And he describes his poem as, "A thing slipped idly from me." He said, "Our poesy is as a gum which oozes from whence 'tis nourished. The fire of the flint shows not till it be struck. Our gentle flame provokes itself, and like the current flies, each bound it chafes." So it was very easy for Shakespeare, it seems. Yeah. But some have to strike for it. And one of the images I had of making early on came from my neighborhood, from a forge, a blacksmith's forge, a mile up the road, which is still there. The blacksmith now, well over his 80s, is still there. And he brought in the millennium by striking the anvil 12 times on the eve of the millennium. Anyway, this is called The Forge. It was the title poem, really, of my second book, Door into the Dark. The Forge. All I know is a door into the dark. Outside, old axles and iron hoops rusting. Inside, the hammered anvil's short pitched ring, the unpredictable fantail of sparks, or hiss when a new shoe toughened in water. The anvil must be somewhere at the center, horned as a unicorn, at one end square, set there immovable. An altar where he expends himself in shape and music. Sometimes, leather-aproned, hairs in his nose, he leans out on the jamb, recalls a clatter of hoofs where traffic is flashing in rows, then grunts and goes in with a slam and flick to beat rail iron out, to work the bellows. Of course, the blacksmith's kind of a sacred, mystical figure in all traditions, Celtic, Anglo-Saxon, Greek. The Shield of Achilles by Auden, about the making of the thing by Hephaestus. And in Beowulf, the poem which Anglo-Saxon poem which Dennis mentioned, many of the weapons are always described as made by smiths of yore, smithwork, magical smithwork, smithwork. And there's a wonderful pride in describing the hammered work of helmets, shields, swords, and so on. I want to read a poem which is more recent called Helmet. It was a gift from a Boston fireman. It was on my shelf for 20 years. It was one of those things that gathering dumbly in silence, the unspoken hovered over it, wanted out, but couldn't get out. Then a terrible circumstance of September 11, 2001 occurred, and they need to write about the fireman's helmet and crease. Anyway, after all that, it's quite a small poem, but it got done. I thought I might read this little bit out of Beowulf, which was at the back of my mind always, is where the poet describes this gift of the helmet given to Beowulf by King Hrothgar. This a really terrific war helper. "An embossed ridge," says the poet, a bed rod lapped with wire arched over the helmet, protective headgear to keep the hard ground cutting edge from damaging it when danger threatened and the man was battling wild behind his shield. The Thane, as they called him, fought with his war board or his shield. The line of battle in Anglo-Saxon poetry was the shield wall, and your comrade was called your shoulder companion. And some of that Anglo-Saxon diction gets into this poem. So, helmet. Bobby Breen's, his Boston fireman's gift, with Breen in scarlet lacquer on its spread fan-tailing brim. Tinctures of sweat and hair oil in the weathered sponge and shock-absorbing webs beneath the crown. Or better say the crest, for crest it is. Steel ridge, leather-trimmed, hand-tooled, hand-sewn, tipped with a little clasp of beaten copper. Badged helmet 17 sits on my shelf like a trophy. The headgear of the tribe, as O'Grady called it, in right heroic mood that afternoon, when the fireman poet presented it to me as the visiting fireman 20 years ago. As if I were up to it. As if I had served time under it. His fire thane shield, his shoulder awning, while shattering glass and rubble bolts out of a burning roof hailed down on every hatchet man and hose man till the hard-reared shield wall broke. After that day, a poem which I had cherished for different reasons took on new strengths and new strangeness. So Horace, a poem by Quintus Horatius Flaccus, a Latin poet of the Augustan age. Anybody interested, it's in Carmina Liber Primus, it's the first book of Odes, number 34. Horace, in this poem, gets a shock. He says, I'm a pretty cool kind of guy, I'm not really gospel greedy, I'm go with the crowd, but something happened that really put the wind up me. Oops. And the terms of the poem, it's really about poetry's covenant with the irrational, I thought, first of all. It's about thunder in the clear blue sky, shock, Jupiter, the thunder god, boom. And, but some of the terms used were so resonant in a new world of the 21st century. He talked about the valet ima deus, the God certainly has power, he said. He can mutare summa, he can change the highest for the lowest. He can promens ignota, he can bring the unknown forward. And this moment of great danger, great grief, great dread, promised a retilting of the world in all kinds of ways, both the hammer coming down and something else perhaps you've been shown new. It required what the poet W.B. Yeats said that was required of every kind of mature intellect. It required us to hold in a single thought reality and justice. Beautiful to formulate, extremely difficult to manage. But the danger and menace of this was in the poem for me. So this is called Horace and the Thunder. Three stanzas of Horace, one stanza of Heaney, but I'll not tell you which is which. Horace and the Thunder. Anything can happen. You know how Jupiter will mostly wait for clouds to gather head before he hurls the lightning. Well, just now, he galloped his thunder cart and his horses across a clear blue sky. It shook the earth and the clogged under earth, the river Styx, the winding streams, the Atlantic shore itself. Anything can happen. The tallest things be overturned. Those in high places daunted. Those overlooked regarded. Strupped beak fortune swoops, making the air gasp, tearing the crest off one, setting it down bleeding on the next. Ground gives. The heaven's weight lifts up off Atlas like a kettle lid. Capstones shift. Nothing resettles right. Smoke furl and boiling ashes darken day. Smoke furl and boiling ashes have been familiar in Northern Ireland for 30 years, 25 years. Explosions, fires. The next poem has the ashes in it. It's a sestina, so you can be sure there are 39 lines coming up, six sixes and three, and the six end lines, remember, the six end words are repeated, including the word Marafelt, the place I mentioned already, where an IRA bomb blew up a whole centre of the town, including a bus station, which I had known since childhood, where I had often met my mother. And the poem goes from the 1940s to the 1980s. It has one, I think, of the more romantic titles that I have concocted. It's called Two Lorries. Two Lorries. First in the 1940s, the second in the 1980s, delivering a proxy bomb to this centre of this village. So it begins with the mother working. It's raining on black coal and warm wet ashes. There are tire marks in the yard. Agnew's old lorry has all its cribs down, and Agnew the coal man with his Belfast accent sweet-talking my mother. Would she ever go to a film in Marafelt? But it's raining, and he still has half the load to deliver further on. This time the load our coal came from was silk black, so the ashes will be the silkiest white. The Marafelt via Tombridge bus goes by. The half-stripped lorry with its emptied, folded coal bags moves my mother. The tasty ways of a leather-aproned coal man. And films no less, the conceit of a coal man. She goes back in and gets out the black lead and emery paper. This 1940s mother, all business round her stove, half wiping ashes with a backhand for her cheek as the bolted lorry gets revved and turned and heads for Marafelt and the last delivery. Oh, Marafelt, oh, dream of red plush and a city coal man. As time fast forwards, and a different lorry groans into shot up Broad Street with a payload that will blow the dust, that will blow the bus station to dust and ashes. After that happened, I'd a vision of my mother, a revenant on the bench where I would meet her in that cold-floored waiting room in Marafelt, her shopping bags filled up with shoveled ashes. Death walked out past her like a dust-faced coal man, refolding body bags, plying his load empty upon empty in a flurry of motes and engine revs. But which lorry was it now? Young Agnew's, or that other, heavier, deadlier one, set to explode in a time beyond her time in Marafelt? So tally bags and sweet talk darkness, coal man. Listen to the rain spit in new ashes as you heft a load of dust that was Marafelt. Then reappear from your lorry as my mother's dream boat, coal man, filmed in silk white ashes. Two sonnets I wrote after my mother died, Memories of Childhood, of that house in Moss Bon. One of peeling potatoes and one of folding sheets. Très intime. My mother and I used to go to early mass, and all the rest of the family, which was copious and numerous, went to late mass. So the house was still and quiet. When all the others were away at mass, I was all hers as we peeled potatoes. They broke the silence, let fall one by one, like solder weeping off the soldering iron. Cold comfort set between us, things to share, gleaming in a bucket of clean water. And again let fall. Little pleasant splashes from each other's work would bring us to our senses. So, while the parish priest at her bedside went hammer and tongs at the prayers for the dying, and some were responding, and some crying, I remembered her head bent towards my head, her breath in mine, our fluent dipping knives, never closer the whole rest of our lives. The cool that came off sheets just off the line made me think the damp must still be in them. But when I took my corners of the linen and pulled against her, first straight down the hem and then diagonally, then flapped and shook the fabric like a sail in a crosswind, they made a dried out, undulating thwack. So we'd stretch and fold and end up hand to hand for a split second, as if nothing had happened. For nothing had, that had not always happened beforehand, day by day, just touch and go, coming close again by holding back, in moves where I was X and she was O, inscribed in sheets she'd sewn from ripped out flour sacks. I knew great experiences were in store in New Mexico. My wife and I came with great pleasure in the company of our companions, the O'Driscoll and the O'Callaghan Poetry Factory. And then something quite wonderful happened as we drove up towards the ski lifts. For the first time, my wife saw a skunk. Small skunk, but nevertheless a skunk. 1976, I had written a poem called The Skunk, which she mercifully liked. So this is it. I was in California for 12 weeks in doing a residency or teaching there. And I was on a beautiful house on Mount Tamalpais Road. It's a house sitting. And the owner had said before she left, listen to me, a family of skunks may come along. Just stay very still. They pass over the veranda. Just stay still. Nothing will happen. So, right enough, one night, there she came, this Mae West figure. Again. She was alone, and I was alone. All of a tremble. She passed. I stayed. All was fine. So when I came back, I wrote this poem. The skunk. Up. Black. Striped and damasked. Like the chasuble at a funeral mass. The skunk's tail paraded the skunk. Night after night, I expected her like a visitor. The refrigerator whinnied into silence. My desk light softened beyond the veranda. Small oranges loomed in the orange tree. I began to be tense as a voyeur. After 11 years, I was composing love letters again, broaching the word wife like a stored cask, as if its slender vowel had mutated into the night earth and air of California. The beautiful, useless tang of eucalyptus spelt your absence. The aftermath of a mouthful of wine was like inhaling you off a cold pillow. And there she was, the intent and glamorous, ordinary, mysterious skunk. Mythologized, demythologized, snuffing the boards 5 feet beyond me. It all came back to me last night, stirred by the sootfall of your things at bedtime. Your head down, tail up, hunt in a bottom drawer for the black plunge line nightdress. I read that poem, Door into the Dark. All I know is a door into the dark. Of course, dark, shutting your eyes to see the blind, the image of the blind as the visionary thing. Deep, 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 old, old image. I was blessed to have a blind neighbour who played music and who, I once read her a poem about a well in her back of her house. And she said, oh, I can see it now. I can see it. Best review I ever got. My wife has something of that kind of visionary quality about her too. When she starts to sing, she shuts her eyes. There's a line in Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock where Joxer Daly, the ingratiating little Dubliner who's in the play, he's a singer, and at the party when he gets drunk, somebody says to him, give us one of your shut-eyed ones, Joxer. This is called At the Wellhead, the well being the one which I wrote about, which he plays. It's a double sonnet. At the Wellhead. Your songs, when you sing them with your two eyes closed, as you always do, are like a local road we have known every turn off in the past. That midge-veiled, high-hedged side road where you stood looking and listening until a car would come and go and leave you lonelier than you had been to begin with. So, sing on, dear shut-eyed one, dear far-voiced veteran. Sing yourself to where the singing comes from, ardent and cut off, like our blind neighbour who played the piano all day in her bedroom. Her notes came out to us like hoisted water ravelling off a bucket at the wellhead, where next thing we'd be listening, hushed and awkward. That blind from birth, sweet-voiced, withdrawn musician was like a silver vein in heavy clay, night water glittering in the light of day, but also just our neighbour, Rosie Keenan. She touched our cheeks. She let us touch her braille in books like books wallpaper patterns came in. Her hands were active, and her eyes were full of open darkness and a watery shine. She knew us by our voices. She'd say she saw whoever or whatever. Being with her was intimate and helpful, like a cure you didn't notice happening. When I read a poem with Keenan's well in it, she said, I can see the sky at the bottom of it now. Just two poems to end with. St. Kevin and the Blackbird. Very old story about St. Kevin, who is a historical figure. This poem, therefore, the story about him is probably true enough. If it's not historically true, it's true now in some other way. It's a shut-eyed vision of Kevin himself is like that, and we have to close our eyes to see him perfectly. St. Kevin and the Blackbird, old story. I have my hands like this for some reason, but it's not saintliness, it's anxiety. The old saints didn't pray like this, they prayed like this. I mean, the Celtic ones kept their hands out. And then there was Saint Kevin and the blackbird. The saint is kneeling, arms stretched out inside his cell. But the cell is narrow, so one turned up palm is out the window, stiff as a crossbeam. When a blackbird lands and lays in it and settles down to nest, Kevin feels the warm eggs, the small breast, the tucked neat head and claws, and finding himself linked into the network of eternal life, is moved to pity. Now he must hold his hand like a branch out in the sun and rain for weeks, until the young are hatched and fledged and flown. And since the whole thing's imagined anyhow, imagine being Kevin. Which is he? Self-forgetful or in agony all the time, from the neck on out down through his hurting forearms? Are his fingers sleeping? Does he still feel his knees? Or has the shut-eyed blank of under-earth crept up through him? Is there distance in his head? Alone and mirrored clear in love's deep river, to labor and not to seek reward, he prays. A prayer his body makes entirely, for he has forgotten self, forgotten bird, and on the river bank, forgotten the river's name. And this is a PS, it's called Postscript. It's about driving west. The phrase going west from the First World War has connotations of mortality, fatality, to go west. And there's a very beautiful cadence in the last story of Joyce's Dubliners, when the dead, the story is called, when Joyce says it was time for him to set out on his journey westward. So this is a memory of a vivid journey westward that we had. Postscript. And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare, along the flaggy shore, in September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other, so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among stones, the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earth lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass, as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
I was going to begin with a remark that you made to an English journalist, where you said, "My notion was always that if the poems were good, they would force their way through." I was wondering, was that still your experience?
I regret possibly not keeping more in the notebook. I did always believe that. I was always busy, to tell you the truth, with other things. I began to write in earnest when I was 23 in 1962, when I read contemporary poetry. Eagerness, excitement, a sense of change came over me when those first poems occurred. They occurred through the charge of other, they occurred through reading. So I've always associated the moment of writing with a moment of lift, of joy, of reward, totally unexpected. And for better or worse, I got this notion that labor wouldn't help. Being a young Catholic and a more or less turning into an old one, in between being a great blank, I've got this notion of grace. And I do believe, unless that there is energy to begin with, that you can't go ahead. Nevertheless, I do feel that maybe a poem should have been forced more. I always believe that the things that were, as I say, had to be written would make themselves written. That was early days when there was plenty of charge in the battery. But I still can't get away from that. I don't know how to write a poem unless there's something to write a poem with.
Yeah. Philip Larkin used to say that you can't write a poem unless you have a poem to write.
Well, Larkin has kind of a grim accuracy about him.
So in I know one of the quotes you used to use quite a lot over the years was that one from Keats, "If poetry comes not as naturally as leaves to a tree, it better not come at all." I'm wondering, is that just a young poet's perspective?
Well, it doesn't mean, and it didn't mean for Keats, that the actual labour of composition or the working on the poem, it doesn't, it's not just a natural function like sneezing. I mean, you do have to work. And one of the best books I got early on, probably in the early 60s, just when I began to write, was a book by John Stallworthy called Between the Lines, and it was about Yeats's manuscripts. And a poem like Cool Park 1928, it's got 32 lines, I think, four ottava rimas. It takes 32 pages of manuscript. It's a middle-range Yeats poem. It's kind of cruising altitude poem, where he's not breaking any sound barriers, but just... And it's iambic pentameter. And yet, there were only three lines given. Now, occasionally, indeed, that has happened, that it's the laboured-for poem, especially if it is a formal poem. I think if you have a stanza form, whatever the stanza form is, whether it's a sonnet or couplets or quatrains or whatever, you can work at that and work with it, because the stanza form immediately calls up all other stanzas in the language. Whether or not you remember them or not, there's a sense of a standard, and you work. There's a standard to work towards and around and away from. The natural is that even the quick free verse poem sometimes happens, but actually, oddly enough, my experience is that it comes quicker if there is a form. Those sonnets to my mother, some of them I wrote very fast. The one about the sheets, I was upstairs in the attic, and I heard a friend of hers, Barry Cook, painter, arriving downstairs unexpectedly, and I had 12 lines written. And I thought, damn him, you know. And I kind of scribbled down two. I'd got 14 before I finished. Yeah. I may have revised it, but... So I think if there is... The thing is there, once again, if there's the energy there, if there's the makings of the thing there, it can come fast. Yeah.
So we all remember that poem by Coleridge, Kubla Khan, where he says he couldn't finish the poem because he was interrupted by a person from Purlock. Yeah. So we now know the name of that person is Barry Cook was his name. So, Seamus, the next thing I was going to ask you was just another very basic kind of question, which is almost as basic as sneezing. I was just thinking, it would be extraordinary if poetry was as contagious as sneezing, and all the great poets were being followed around in the hope that they might actually sneeze in your presence. But anyway, how does a poem actually begin for you? I know this is a very basic question, but you know, is it like a murmur, a sound, an articulation, a music, a phrase, or actually something as specific as, here's a theme I'd like to write on?
Sometimes it's a theme. usually with a larger thing. There's a poem called Station Island, which is 12 sections, and it's kind of based on a pilgrimage to Lough Derg. And this notion kept me at it for 2 years. But the ideal, I think, is to have... my notion is a big wheel. You know these water wheels in Egypt in the desert where you have one big wheel revolving and it's got little hangers and dippers that lift the water and it keeps turning around, big slow motion, and the water comes up and they come down in the fill. That big theme that keeps little dippings going on, that's ideal. But so you want a big conception for that. Sometimes it can be a theme, but sometimes in my experience is a form also. If you get on to writing sonnets, write one sonnet, then try another. That keeps you going. But generally speaking, my poems come from remembered things. Quite often from a way back, or things I see that remind me of something else. Little bleepers, I call them, that send off something. And sometimes, like the helmet, a thing that has an aura and an invitation and some kind of blocked significance hanging around it, waiting to be written for. I'm a great hoarder of things. And I did a little sequence of poems one time called Shelf Life, things that are on the that I kept picked up like bits of stone, stick, and old smoothing iron that belonged in our house and so on. Usually it's a thing or an image. Rarely is it a musical thing. But you can't get started with them without some kind of first line that goes musically. So it's things, memories, little pebbles that hopefully start, if not an avalanche, a snowball of some sort.
Yeah. I mentioned in the introduction that you're a critic as well as a poet and produced a lot of essays and reviews and that. Can you mix those two? In other words, can you be actually working on a lecture, an article, a review, and at the same time or the same day, say, work on a poem? Or do you need a particular day for one, a particular day for the other? Or would you divide your day, so to say, I'll give 2 hours in the morning to poetry and I'll work on prose later in the day? Like, is there a poetry time of day and a prose time of day?
Well, it used to be I wrote whatever I did, I wrote at night. That was my 20s, 30s, 40s. And partly because I was teaching and busy all day and marking scripts and doing this, that, and the other and living a full life with the thrilling Heaney household. So the house quietened later at night. Now the house is quiet all day.
Yeah.
And I tend now to work in the morning, certainly. And I would be now more luckier to have morning time to write, and I would try to write poems in the morning if poems are coming. But I don't have a time of day for poems and a time of day for essays. In fact, my experience is that prose usually equals duty and last minute overdue deadline stuff. Or else there's a panic lecture to be written. The odd thing is that my first book of poems, which were life-changing for me to write those poems, felt blessed and challenged and strange and lucky. And this book of poems, I'm convinced, I know, got me into a university. Nowadays, you don't get in for that. I mean, I got into an English department, not a creative writing department, but a teaching, full teaching English department in Queen's. And I said to the professor, I was a BA among PhDs on the staff. I said, well, do I need now to do a secondary degree, do you think? He said, no, bless him. He said, no, no. He said, most people do those degrees to get the job you have. So he said, what you want to do is write critical essays now and again. So from the beginning, there was an element of the duty dance of the good boy doing his university work about my criticism. And it continued like that, and continues like that. But I also felt, I was a teacher, and I felt a pleasure when I had written it, in uttering it, writing it down and speaking it out. And in those years in Oxford, when I gave the lectures and so on, I would bury myself in a cottage. I neglected to say it, an important aspect of my actual writing life is another house Murray and I got. We lived in it for 4 years, en famille, in the early 70s. Then we were able to buy it, late 80s, and it saved my writing life because I was able to disappear from our home, which was becoming like a cross between a travel agency and a telephone exchange, and bury myself down there. I would get 2 days to get this lecture done for Oxford. But the blessed thing was that a lot of my poems were written in that intense time, as an escape from the intensity of the lecture. So some of the poems I liked best were written in the lay-bys from the main motorway of the lecture.
Yeah.
I mean, so that you escape from yourself. I mean, I do in poems. You know, you forget yourself and you get into a hurry and an intense.
So instead of commissioning you to write a poem, somebody should commission you to write a lecture. And
yeah.
And they get the poem as well.
Right.
So I was going to ask you just a few, one or two other questions along those lines, and then maybe we change tack a bit. But I know one poet who says that his wife always knows when he's going to write a poem because his breathing changes. And I was wondering, I remember Yeats's daughter saying that he used to start sort of mumbling to himself when he'd start to write. So is there a kind of change of mood? Are you, like, when you're a bit more melancholy, when you're a bit more intense, would the Heaney household know that a poem was coming on?
Well, actually, maybe not so much in the house because I would withdraw a bit, but I do know that one of the best incubating times for me and baiting out the baits of a poem is on long drives. And my wife always knows because driving for long journeys with the spouse is very stilling. And she sees my fingers on the steering wheel beating out the thing. And that is true. Mm. Many, many poems that I have conceived of and started are in that shut-eyed... No, well, not literally shut-eyed. But you know how you can go 50 miles in it before you're waking up?
Yeah.
The car element, that is certainly one trance that is there. Mm. The other is to go, I have to say, going to this cottage, which is built, it's kind of an old 19th century gate lodge, and it brings me back to that first house in the way that I was in, because when it used to have a latch, and the sound of a latch was like a sound of the primal world. Mm. And I felt psychologically, physically safe in it. Mm. I felt that my first self was guaranteed by this place. And I always found it conducive to writing. In fact, so satisfactory that you almost didn't need to write. So the car and the cottage, and now the attic. Mm. I used to very much like claustrophobic conditions, facing the wall with a low set ceiling. And in fact, in the cottage, we had this lovely old low ceiling. And one of the different attitudes, one of the things my wife might sort of disagree with the book was she liked the idea of a skylight. And I said, no. Keep the hutch and the hatch down. So when I was in Harvard one time and I came back and I went upstairs in the cottage. The skylight. And actually it was a tremendous change for me. And it was something to do with getting near 50, I think, where I lifted up my eyes to the heavens and I now feel that the light, and I have a light in my attic at home, rather than a door into the dark, a door into the light is what we're after now. So.
Because, in fact, I mean, the car obviously has a view and the cottage has a view and the attic doesn't have a view. Because I know your friend Ted Hughes used to advise writers to get all the books out of the room, never write in a room with books, have no view of any kind at all. I was wondering, did you have any view on that?
Well, I used to find chain smoking very helpful. Actually, I'm sure many writers in the room have stopped smoking and there's a crisis.
So they, any sort of would-be writers in the room, two things to do. One is learn how to drive and the other is learn how to smoke.
No, well, I've forgotten the question, but the view.
The view, yeah.
Well, seriously, I didn't want a view early on. And the cottage has a view, but it's straight into the hillside, you know. Mm. It's not a vista. Mm. It's a kind of early Irish hermit's view of the wood. And this was very conducive to the early Irish hermit's poetry, because they were in the dark and they saw that bit of light, and the radiance of a God-filled universe was there in that wee slit, and that was good. And actually, there were, in the Irish language tradition, as we know, there were bardic schools, professional poetry schools, up until, I guess, the 17th century or well into it. And they were, as we remember, made to compose in the dark, lie in their cubicle and compose at night. And they were made to memorize stuff and compose in these set forms. And then the professors, the Olive, would come in and they would be examined in candlelight. So there's a traditional kind of ratification for the claustrophobic element in composition. Mm-hmm.
And would you ever sometimes be so intimidated, in a sense, by a poem you had to write? In other words, that you'd know what was required of you to write this poem was going to be so demanding, demanding of time, demanding of spirit, demanding of emotion, demanding of yourself, that you would almost distract yourself deliberately not to write it. I mean, are there those kinds of poems where you yourself feel almost burdened by what you know to do justice to a particular inspiration you're going to have to do?
Well, one or two of things. I mean, I mentioned Station Island. One of the difficulties is to know whether a little quick flash of lyric is how do you. You have the invitation and the inspiration, for want of a better word. It's a question that I never know whether the will should do the work of the imagination, as Yeats said, how far you should push a thing. I used to think, and probably practice bored out, when you're starting, you love the high of finishing. Mm. So you do the lyric quickness, and that's a joy. And you rush round to the other fellow or gal and you say, look, here it is. And I think as you go on, the joy of actually doing it, of beating the gold out further, of making more of it, of thinking, can I take that further, is that's what you really ideally want. But then the doubt comes in, am I killing it? Am I deadening it? Coleridge, I think, said that poems were like schoolboys, that they grew dull from much correction. But there are poems that ask to have more poems attached to them to grow. And the one about Station Island, about the pilgrims and so on, I was able to keep thinking about it for a couple of years. And I did more sections than I put into it. And I didn't know, and this is another question that there are different attitudes to, whether a big lumpy thing that is not as bits of it not as good as you know it should be, but whether imperfection hasn't got its imperatives also, or whether you should make it, you know, trim and as good as possible. I remember Craig Raine, English poet who was an editor at Faber's, he said a poem should be as tightly shut as an oyster. You know, well, you know, Jay Storrsbetter said it should be loose as a big hibiscus. You know, I think that one of the ways you can miss is to fear going through with an inspiration. Yeah.
And with a poem like Station Island, how did you know it was finished? At what point did you decide, I let this go and move on? Or indeed, in general, how do you know a poem is finished?
Well, I think we're talking here, Station Island is a sequence with separate finished bits put together to make a bigger finished thing. So there are movements in it and so on. The finishing of a movement is, that's one of the most difficult things to talk about in a situation like this. How do you know a thing is finished? I had a friend, Hugh Braden, a philosopher, who went to Italy, to the University of Torino, studied philosophy of Croce. He wanted to do a PhD on this very question, on how the artist knew that the work was finished. He couldn't actually proceed with it because there was no documentation whatsoever. And you see it physically in painters. Therefore, said Barry Cook, I spent a painter friend. But you see it in any painter, prowling around a canvas, and the body is, you know, distressed and stressed. And then, you know, there's almost a, when it's finished, okay, you know, the body relaxes. I don't know how, you know when it's not finished, at least.
And do you know that it is not good, for instance? In other words, when you'd write a poem, would you be fairly confident of your own judgment of that poem? And does it normally, in fact, even years afterwards, pretty much prove to be the case that your initial qualitative assessment of the poem, how good it is, stands up?
Yes, I would have to say it pretty much is the case. And the other thing is that the stuff that's written pretty quickly pretty much is the stuff. I mean, my experience is that a lot of the poems I have fondness for, not all by any means, but a lot of the poems that stand up, I remember them coming smartly through. Like, for example, that postscript which I'm fond of, or wrote it quickly. On the other hand, there are poems in a book called North that were grimly executed. And I really like them because they're odd as odd, and I think hard and contrary. And
would you dip into a notebook much? I know you mentioned the word notebook at the beginning, but I was wondering, would you have, say, little phrases and images and things that clearly belonged in a poem, but you had to later recognize what that poem was?
I don't keep a notebook regularly. I haven't kept a notebook. And what I depend upon is mood to generate those things. I remember seeing in the early 70s, at least one book by the poet Theodore Rethke, which is called Straw for the Fire. It was a book of lines that didn't get into poems. It's a quite exciting book itself. And I thought, God, I could never do that at all. There's no straw. I don't know. Just old brick. But I do have notes, little lists of things, subjects and so on. To go back to your question, where you would write, some of the places which are useful are long aeroplane journeys as well as car journeys, and seclusions in hotel rooms. I find those escapes from your normal life, displacements, useful for making lists and for images to come up, and those notions and memories to be there, little titles.
Yeah. What about timing then? I mean, would you have this feeling that it's very important to know when to start and when it's too soon to start a particular poem? In other words, should it be let marinate and distill and gestate and all those kinds of things?
Those are the complete uncertainties, I think. I tend to think, even though I don't always practice it, I tend to believe that a quick attack is the way to do it. And forget anxiety about how good it's going to be. Go and do it. On the other hand, I couldn't have written about the helmet, just to take some of that away. This fireman's helmet, long before the fireman became a kind of heroic figure, the helmet itself had a heroic aura. Mm. And I knew it must have written about, but I knew the day I got it, but I couldn't quite do it. And I knew after I translated Beowulf, there was something, not that it's a big, not a big deal to wait for, but just to get the right moment. So when I finally wrote it, I just jumped on it unexpectedly one morning when it wasn't waiting, looking.
Yeah. And translation, which we mentioned, obviously, with Beowulf and Sweeney Astray, but you also do odd little individual translations from the Gaelic, from the Irish. Do you decide to do those when there are no poems, as it were, presenting themselves, or are they just as much part of your writing process as original poems, as it were?
My first engagement with translation was in order to give myself a task. I resigned from that job in the university after 6 years there in 1972. I was going to be free, so to speak, freelance for a year. But I was used to a job. I'd always thought that's what you did when you grew up, have a job. And also I gave myself a job. I got this long Middle Irish poem, prose piece, and assigned it to myself as a job to be done. It had delightful poetic invitation in it, and I knew it to some extent was my subject about trees and so on. The American poet Robert Lowell, who I was lucky enough to know the last 3 or 4 years of his life, great man, great furnace of intellect, and a great a lot of affection and a lot of mockery, high intelligence, nothing safe with him. So somebody asked him about my poems. After I translated this Sweeney poem, which had a lot of nature in it. And so somebody said, what about Heaney's poems? And he said, lots of trees, lots of trees. Actually not that many trees, but, you know. So the translation began as a job. And the second big job, the Beowulf was a big job. It was like breaking stones. It was taken on as such. More recently, I thought I'd do some Irish language translations, one-off poems that I'd done and love for pleasure and joy. So I now actually like translation because it's a form of writing by proxy. You know, you get the high of finishing something, but you don't have to start it.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier about finding the form early, and clearly form is very important in your work, and you have sonnet sequences, a lot of work that is rhymed and so forth. Would you be offended if somebody called you a formalist?
I wouldn't be offended, but I think it would be a mistake.
Yeah.
A formalist to me sounds like a kind of doctrinaire position. You know, moi, j'écris en...
He's translating again.
You know, I write in stanzas and so on. I totally believe in form, but I think that quite often when people it's used, they mean shape rather than form. I mean, there are shapes. There's the sonnet shape. Now, it's not just a matter of rhyming and 8 and 6. The 8 and 6 happen to be set on top of other, like two boxes. It's more like a torso and a pelvis. There has to be a little bit of movement. It has to be alive in some sort of way. It has to... A moving poem doesn't just mean that it touches you. It means it has to move along. So unless there's energy and movement in the shape, if not an inert... I mean, in other words, form isn't like a pastry cutter that you go along and say, boom, there's a wee poem, there's a wee poem, there's... The sonnet, the 14-line shape you put down. No, it has to be discovered. But I love to get a feeling that my own voice is on track. And that can happen within a metrical shape or it can happen within a free shape. Generally, I'm pretty close to the iambic pentameter. But It's my own, I go by the ear and some sense of fidelity to the whatever I'm hearing or whatever. Yeah.
But you say there the form has to be discovered, but that prompts me to ask, have you ever discovered a form?
The only thing I would think of as my own, not a discovery, but it was a thing I went through with, is a 12-line shape, four threes. I had this poem. I was working, like, once again, working very hard on another thing. Mm. Somebody gave me a job to do an annotation of a selection of W.B. Yeats's poems. Mm. And I worked and worked in the National Library of Ireland for about 6 weeks. And the day I finished it, I was sitting in this most beautiful reading room with the rain on the glass on top. And suddenly I wrote a few lines, and it became a 12-line, 4-3-lines thing. And it felt given. I didn't quite know where it came from. It was marvellous stuff as far as I was concerned. It was strange and unexpected. And then I thought, well, there's something here that can continue. So I did another 12 lines next day. Then I did another 12. And then I thought, maybe I could do 12 12-liners and call it squarings, because the word squarings came in. So I'd managed that. Then I thought, God, maybe I could do 144 of them. But that didn't quite, I did 48. But the arbitrariness, we talked earlier about a theme aspiring. The arbitrary shape can be done. And I was able to do them fast, and the idea was I would pounce on them, again, get through it quickly. So if any, it's not a discovery, but it was, I mean, it's not an original form, 4-3-line things, but it worked for me as a generator of poetry.
Mm. Well, there's a poem called A Call by Seamus Heaney, in which he listens on a waiting telephone to the amplified grave ticking of hall clocks. And I'm afraid the clocks in this hall have begun to amplify. And it's time to unwind and thank Seamus Heaney for being so absorbing that he made time stand still. Seamus mentioned earlier that the word Lennon is a magic word. And I do want to thank Patrick Lennon, all the members of his family, his board, and, of course, his staff. Always helpful, always cheerful, unfailingly thoughtful, ever inspiring, generous and hospitable. I also want to thank Don Usner, the photographer, the video crew, the staff at the Lensic, and not least our friends in Garcia Street Books, who keep us poring over the books when the readings are over. They will be here to sell books, and books can be signed. Some of them are already pre-signed. And I want, of course, to thank you for being a wonderful audience. I was wondering, could I break the Lennon rules before we change? And if somebody had a copy of one of Seamus's books, to ask him to read one of those 12-line forms that he invented. Maybe the one about the monks at Clonmacnoise,
all right,
just to end the evening.
Thanks a lot.
We need
I think
a book.
I have that. Anyway.
Yeah.
Thanks, Fred. Yeah, thank you. This is another story. True story, too, in this way. It's from the annals of Clonmacnoise, this early medieval monastery. They kept these annals. Not much was recorded year by year. Maybe they say, the Norseman came. Yeah. But it's all dead plain, as was this story. The annals say, when the monks of Clonmacnoise were all at prayers inside the oratory, a ship appeared above them in the air. The anchor dragged along behind so deep it hooked itself into the altar rails. And then, as the big hull rocked to a standstill, A crewman shinned and grappled down the rope and struggled to release it, but in vain. "This man cannot bear our life here and will drown," the abbot said, "unless we help him." So they did. The freed ship sailed, and the man climbed back out of the marvelous as he had known it. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantica, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.